This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places, in fact, to the very streets of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Teotakis. Past Beef Bowls and Auto Zones, the Sherman Oaks Galleria, we drive deeper and deeper into the San Fernando Valley.
I will say that one thing I love about the San Fernando Valley is that the parking lots are really big. Down in the valley. There's ample parking, and I love that.
Michael Niemand has lived in the valley his entire life. He's not leaving anytime soon.
I also love that it's a giant grid. It's falsely accused of being boring. You know, I just love the feel of it. It just feels like home.
Oh, the places you'll go on Greater LA, you never know what you'll find. Today, it's a street that you probably never heard of.
I grew up on Rosendale Avenue, and if you just think about the name, there's quite a lot of potential there.
Rosendale Avenue in Arleta, in the northeastern corner of the San Fernando Valley. What can the name of this ordinary residential street tell us about the region that we all live in? What's in a name, especially a street name? It's a question Greater LA will be exploring in a series of stories over the next few weeks. And reporter Mike Schlitt gets us started.
So you've met my friend Michael Niemand. Let me tell you, he is obsessed with San Fernando Valley street names.
I wouldn't say obsessed, but when I look at a map and it's just filled with all of these tiny lines, in my head, I just know that every one of those lines is just filled with stories.
I don't really ever think about street names unless I'm lost.
Well, you're really missing out, I'm afraid.
Deirdre Mask wrote a whole book on street names and addresses.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we often think of street names as just being something quite practical, right? Market Street was where the market was. Church Street was where the church is. You
know, she says for centuries, street names were chosen specifically to help people not get lost. But eventually, people stopped needing street names to describe the places they were going.
And then the game begins to change. Naming becomes interconnected with what a place means, to store memories and store ideas.
On the way to the Northeast Valley, you'll pass descriptive street names.
Laurel Canyon, the 70s.
Commemorative street names.
Mulholland, the Grand Poobah.
Aspirational street names.
Victory Boulevard. I've always struggled to find anything victorious about it.
And street names that are just straight-up lies.
I went to Beachy Avenue Elementary School. Beachy, like sort of like the beach. Like if there were a beach in Arleta. Let's go surfing now,
everybody's learning how. People want to live on a street that is a desirable name. And marketers know that. There are streets that are marketed very much to sound like affluent places, to correspond street names with house value.
If you want to find the real story behind the street names, sometimes you just got to go there. Today, let's go to Rosendale Avenue.
So I'm on Rosendale Avenue. I spent my whole life on the street. Let me just pull over here for a second. Most people are probably wondering why I'm stopped in front of their house.
Rosendale Avenue first appeared on the map in 1952 in one of nine new tracks built that year between Canterbury and Beachy. At the time, it was part of Pacoima. Now it's Arleta. Talk about a bunch of great names. On Michael's block, there are 35 houses and 38 sycamore trees.
In our little track, I always felt that we had the best street.
So what do we make of the name Rosendale? Sounds kind of fancy, right? So maybe you'd expect fancy people would want to live there?
Oh, I'm packing my grill and I'm leaving today.
In 1952, my wife Regina and I decided to come out to California.
So that's your dad, right?
That's my dad, 92 years old. He's quite a guy.
And everybody calls him by a nickname.
Well, everyone calls him Big Murray. Yeah.
And how tall was he?
About 5'8".
And make the San Fernando Valley my home.
There was a tool and die maker. I was living with my mother, so you know I was desperate. I packed my toolbox up and I brought it with me, and I ended up going to work for Hughes Aircraft.
When Big Murray arrived, aerospace jobs in Southern California took off like a rocket for engineers and blue-collar guys.
The dream of aerospace suburbs was always of an upward trajectory.
DJ Waldy wrote a book called Holy Land, a suburban memoir. He lives in the same Lakewood home his parents bought in 1946.
Everyone's expectations that next year's paycheck will be bigger than this year's paycheck. You can imagine what that might mean to people who had only a high school education.
We went out there and we looked at a number of houses out in the valley. And then we went to look at this one in Pacoima, and we liked this one. But who knew from Pacoima?
Who knew from Pacoima? Well, Black and Latino people knew. In 1952, Pacoima was one of the only places in the valley they could buy a home. On Roslindale, when Big Murray arrived, there were already Jewish, Japanese, and Latino families living there.
Those young men and young women, many of them former GIs, didn't want more. They wanted just enough. All the developer had to do was put an ad in the LA Times, and there would be a line of people out in front with a firm conviction that they were going to buy that house.
The house Big Murray had his eye on was 1,200 square feet, 3 bedrooms, 1 3/4 baths, asphalt driveway, cheaper than concrete, attached garage, cheaper than a detached garage, and a tiny backyard right next to a bunch of giant transmission towers. Now that was a real cost saver.
It was a $12,000 house, no money down, $12,240. I remember that because I was a veteran. They gave me back the $240.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream.
I don't know that somebody would point their finger out to the Northeastern Valley on Roslindale Street and say, this is where I want to be. But I think if they ended up there, I think they'd probably be pretty happy.
Michael stops in front of a little beige house, right next to two of those transmission towers, just a few doors down from where he grew up. And this house, I don't know, it's just so ordinary, nondescript. It's the kind of house you could walk by a million times and you'd never even notice it. Which might be the reason.
That was the house that they used in Back to the Future.
Oh, it was on your street?
Yeah. It was on our street. Roslindale Avenue is the street that the DeLorean drives down, takes off. So,
God,
I thought I told you that.
When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious.
So, yeah, turns out that's the Marty McFly house from the 1985 movie Back to the Future. Michael J. Fox's character lived in that house with his cowardly dad.
You're right.
And his alcoholic mom.
We're going to have to eat this cake by ourselves.
This McFly family, they are all just incredibly unfulfilled people.
I'm sorry.
But it all works out in the end, thanks to a little time travel intervention. In the very last shot of the movie, the DeLorean hovers up in the air, then glides off through a lush canopy of sycamore trees. Roslindale sycamore trees. The music swells, the audience swoons, the box office soars.
Susie, is that you?
Mike Neiman.
Hey, Susie.
Hi, Mrs. Moskowitz.
When we meet some neighbors, Michael tells them we're doing a radio story on LA streets. And all anyone wants to talk about...
The Back to the Future house is on this street.
Is it the Back to the Future house? Or like, no, it's 3 houses down.
But eventually, we do start talking about other things.
I love the trees on the street.
I never had a key to my house. My house was always open.
Everybody seems to know everybody.
So we have Filipino, a lot of Latino, a lot of, there's Armenian, so it's pretty mixed up.
When my dad had his stroke, the neighboring kids did the lawn and kept the house up.
Where I lived before, it was a mobile home, so it was just obviously an improvement.
Now, I gotta say, unlike the McFly family, all of these people seem pretty fulfilled. And I don't think it's just because Back to the Future was filmed here.
I think everyone on the street knew what hard times were. Because of those hard times, they knew what it was like to also know when something was good.
I was born in Poland in 1935. In the town were about 6,000 Jewish families living, and maybe 150 people survived. We came here with absolutely nothing. Well, it was an entirely a different way of living.
What kind of
we
way of life?
We didn't even know that this kind of life existed. I raised my family, and that was the best part of my life.
When you confront a street name, you confront a story. And the story of Roslindale, this tiny street with a fancy name and a lot of down-to-earth people, it's simple. A safe, quiet, ordinary place can be sacred to the people who live there. And also, because it's a Los Angeles street, they shot a movie here. And now people come from all over the world.
Кристина, у меня интервью берут, ты понимаешь, это непростое место.
Just to catch a glimpse of a nondescript house on an ordinary street.
So that's the house.
In the northeast corner of the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out at first which house was it. Now I see it's this one.
You recognize it?
Yes. I'm a big fan of the movie.
On Roslindale Avenue, I'm Mike Schlitt for KCRW.
Coming up, more from our series on the history and boulevards of Los Angeles. The late, great food writer Jonathan Gold called Pico Boulevard one of the most vital food streets in the world. The street is named after the last governor of Mexican California, a portrait of Pio Pico, and the boulevard that carries his name. That's next on Greater LA on KCRW.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now with a special Labor Day edition of KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Pico Boulevard may just be the hardest working street in Los Angeles. Here's how filmmaker and playwright Richard Montoya describes it.
Pico Boulevard is the perfect Los Angeles road. It's a remarkable blue-collar reminder of a city that works and a city that moves and a city that must sleep restlessly.
Pico Boulevard. It is named for one of LA's founding fathers, a real estate baron turned penniless gambler, an indigenous African-American Spanish Mexicano, and the last governor of the Mexican state of California. Got all that? I'm talking about Don Pio de Jesus Pico. Today, as part of the Greater LA series on Los Angeles street names, reporter Mike Schlitt makes the case that Pico Boulevard, as we know it now, has a lot in common with the man who left this L.A. street his name.
If you really want to understand Pico Boulevard, you first have to conjure the man.
Pio Pico was born in a shack at San Gabriel Mission in 1801.
I stood at Pico and Playa.
Pico and Ocean Park.
Pico and Speedway.
He rose from very humble beginnings to become the most powerful and one of the most wealthy men in his time.
Pico and Lincoln. Pico Aliso. Pico de Res.
He lived a long, celebrated life as a public figure, as a politician, as a powerful landowner, merchant, soldier, ranchero.
Pico Garden.
Pico Patrol.
Pico Sig Alert.
He was boastful and prideful. He could be extremely belligerent. And yet, he leaves so much behind.
He certainly left an imprint on California.
Pico de Gallo.
Pico Pulque.
The Pico Housing Project.
Pico Patois.
I went to every single Pico name thing in Southern California to just to try to capture his spirit.
Somehow the man and the legend and the myth is still alive.
P-O-P-O-P.
P-O-P-O-P.
Pico, kosher, glad deli, just over there.
Think about the musicality of Pio Pico.
Pio Pico.
Pio Pico.
Pio Pico.
Pico Pico.
Pico Power Transfer Station.
My name is Don Pio de Jesus Pico.
Pio Pico lived a life so complex, it must be seen and felt and heard with the help of many voices.
I'm L.A. filmmaker and playwright Richard Montoya.
I'm Mildred Lewis. I'm a professor and a theater maker.
William Estrada from the Natural History Museum of L.A. County.
My name is Roberto Garza. I'm an actor, and I had the great honor of portraying the last Mexican governor of California, Pio de Jesus Pico.
I became obsessed with the idea of Pico Boulevard. I don't think there's another street in Los Angeles that's quite like it.
That's the late, great food critic, Jonathan Gold.
I came up with the sort of half-baked coleslaw-inspired idea to eat at every restaurant on Pico Boulevard and to create sort of a map of the senses that would be able to get me from one end to the other.
On Pico, food is the basis of entry-level capitalism.
It awakens before Los Feliz Boulevard. It awakens before Mitchell Torina. It awakens possibly before Griffith Park does.
I get up about 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
I open the restaurant at 4:30 in the morning.
I've been working since 1967, 7 days a week, 14 to 18 hours a day.
My name is Chris. I own Papa Cristo's Greek Restaurant. We've had the same address, same telephone number, and same landlord since 1948.
I'm Carolina Orellana. I'm the chef of La Cevicheria.
My name is Julio Orellana, and I'm her husband and her assistant, and whatever else you want to call me. We are La Cevicheria, Seafood Grill. In the beginning of the menu, she says that ceviche is aphrodisiac.
Pio Pico's life spanned three nations, three flags, colonial Spain, independent Mexico, and the United States.
He was born a Spaniard. He became a Mexican and died an American, all without ever leaving Southern California.
Here's Pico in early California. He's got this confluence, these tributaries, these flags and these bloods running through him.
His people were descendants of populations that had been mixing Indian, African, and European for at least 200 years.
But here's an African, a Mexican, an utterly modern, multicultural Angelino.
I'm Barbara Sky Burrell, and I've been on Pico for about 28 years.
At Sky's Gourmet Tacos, we do tacos a little differently. It's south meets south of the border. Our Mexican with a splash of salt.
My tacos are greasier because I use butter.
I'm Ted Delgado, the owner of Teddy's Cafe and raised on Santa Monica. It will be 33 years. I started washing dishes back in 67. My ex-boss, she don't want to continue, so she offered the restaurant to me. So I bought her the business from her in the name.
Pio Pico, he understood very early in his life that property was the conduit to economic and political power.
If I would start a business, I had to own the property. Because I knew and I see the many businesses, they build up good and then the landlord start to raise the rent or even sell it to somebody else and let you go. So one day the owner was there, he says, you know what, Ted? You asked me many times if I sell you the property, so I will.
My name is Adriana. This was El Parian restaurant and it was founded by my grandfather in the early 70s. My parents worked the restaurant when my grandfather passed away, and since my father passed away, I stepped up and took over. I'm still not in charge because my mom is living. Of course, I went to school and I studied. I'm a dialysis technician, but I make tortillas right now for a living.
Pio Pico, he's governor of the state. He understands land. He understands cattle. He understands water. He understands how things work. And with that comes real power.
And also grave danger.
The North American nation can never be our friend.
Pio Pico didn't come to America. America came to him. But after the Mexican territory of California was taken over by the Yankees, he embraced the American dream and became one of the richest men in the state. And yet, despite all his successes,
he could feel the noose triangulating and strangling him and pushing his family out of power.
In America, he learned how easily it could all be taken away.
My concern is gentrification, and that is happening.
If I were paying rent, I would be gone.
It's scary. I just cross my fingers when the lease comes up to, you know, change.
The neighborhood has survived on small businesses, and eventually I guess it will change. Luckily, I'm 75 years old, so maybe I'm not going to get to see all that.
We're hoping that we overcome this pandemic.
The pandemic really hit the community, and those people are the essential people, and they are the ones who are dying.
This is the toughest time that I've encountered. We have to show strength.
We also have to care for other families.
I never thought I would live to see a time when I would be responsible for so many people's lives.
My grandfather passed away and we didn't close. My father passed away and it didn't close. That if they sacrifice, I think my will should be stronger than theirs. Because if they were willing to do it for us, I should be willing to do it for them.
The pandemic will be over, but the economics of that pandemic will remain for some time.
Pio Pico lost everything, rags to riches to rags.
When you look at the amount of money he lost, how did this man with hundreds of millions of dollars end up in relative squalor?
In his early 90s, Pio Pico received one final business proposition.
They were going to display him at the Chicago World's Exposition in 1893 as the last don. So he was going to be placed as a living exhibit next to Chumash baskets, California oranges, everything that evokes the reality and mythology and romance of Southern California.
The World's Fair wanted to celebrate California exoticism by displaying Pio Pico like a circus animal. But the pay was good, enough to live comfortably for the rest of his life. So what did Pio Pico say?
If those gringos imagine for a moment that they can show me in a side tent at 2 bits ahead, they are very much mistaken.
He didn't just say
no.
He said hell no. His dignity and his pride remained intact. And that's all we can take with us at the end.
Pio Pico was a great steward. He doesn't have children, you know, biologically, but he has adopted children. And he defined his children broadly.
I believe every street carries a vibration. Because there's a spirit of Pico. I mean, you know, Pico brings life to your soul.
You don't need to know anything about Pio Pico to feel his spirit alive on Pico Boulevard. Just imagine a street working hard for the future, living fully in the present, and standing tall in the past. People from all over the world, they're proud members of this family.
I am a child of Pio Pico.
For KCRW, I'm Mike Schlitt on Pico Boulevard.
That's going to do it for us on this special Labor Day episode of Greater LA. We're online, of course, always at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast while you're there. Get every episode of GLA delivered fresh to your feed. Of course, you can find that podcast, too, wherever you get your podcasts. But online, you can share your thoughts with us about your street, perhaps, in LA, or something you want to hear on our show. It's kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Sue Margulies, Jody Adler, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all made today's show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. And to the folks who sweat and toil, keep this country moving forward through thick and thin, through pandemic, even perhaps paltry paychecks. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all you do. Happy Labor Day from all of us at KCRW.